This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 15th of January 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Robert Bounds. Coming up on today's show, from Egypt to Nigeria, we'll review the day's top news stories with Shashank Joshi and James Schneider right here in the studio. Then we'll head to Berlin, where our very own Nelly Gotcheva is scouting out the best new brands at Bread and Butter.
It's very, very interesting to find new brands, and I think that Berlin specifically is very good at launching and kind of promoting new and independent brands.
And later in the show...
It's really amazing that all three of you have accomplished so little in the 4 years since college. I mean, like, think about it, 4 years.
4 years is like nothing.
You can't break up with me. I wouldn't be eating pizza in front of you if I actually liked you.
We'll review the latest in TV, from Girls to the Golden Globes. All that, plus we'll catch up with our man in Budapest and maybe play a bit of music too. That's all coming up right here on Midori House with me, Robert Bound. Plenty to get our teeth into here on Midori House at 18:01, the top of the hour. It's news time with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. A conference has taken place in Kuwait to discuss the crisis in Syria, with more than $2 billion pledged to help those affected by the three-year-old civil war. The money will go towards a United Nations appeal for $6.5 billion, which was launched last month. It's the largest in the history of the United Nations, which estimates that the conflict has rolled back human development gains in Syria by 35 years, with half the population now living in poverty. The spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency is Melissa Fleming.
We came here to seek the generous support of the nations gathered here for the helpless victims of the Syria crisis. We have estimated that we will need $6.5 billion in 2014 to help Syrians who are internally displaced inside the country and Syrians who've been forced to flee outside the country.
Dozens of people have been killed across Iraq on one of the bloodiest days in the country for months. 75 people are dead after a series of bomb attacks and shootings. There were separate attacks in Baghdad and a village north of the capital, as well as in Mosul. Four men charged with helping Al-Qaeda-linked militants launch an attack on a Kenyan shopping centre have appeared in court. They're accused of giving support and shelter to gunmen who killed at least 67 people during the assault on Nairobi's Westgate complex in September. The trial is expected to last a week and heard today from security guards who witnessed the attack. Bahrain's crown prince has met the Shiite Muslim opposition leader in a bid to end 3 years of political deadlock. The meetings come just a week after reconciliation talks were suspended in a setback for efforts to stabilise the Gulf state. Crown Prince Salman Al Khalifa was named first deputy prime minister last year and has pushed for the reconciliation talks and is seen to be spearheading a more reformist line within the Bahraini ruling family. An alleged attack on a Danish woman in India has raised concerns once again about sexual crimes in the country. The 51-year-old claims she was gang-raped and robbed at knife point in New Delhi. This comes after a Polish woman reported being attacked earlier this month and separate attacks last year on an American and a British tourist in India. The leader of the Communist Party of India, Ani Raja, says the government's failed to fulfil its promises over the issue.
This government also somehow did not give a strong message to such anti-women forces that a different government is here and we will not spare anyone if anyone indulge in such crimes. So that is what is why this such an incident has happened again. And I don't think this is the only incident after Mr. Kejriwal's government came into power in Delhi.
Apple says it will refund consumers at least $32.5 million to settle a long-standing complaint that the technology company billed US consumers for charges incurred by children buying mobile apps without their parents' consent. Apple also will be required to change its billing practices to ensure it's obtained consent from consumers before charging for items sold in mobile apps. In an internal memo, CEO Tim Cook explained that the company decided to settle rather than risk a long and distracting legal battle. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David, at 18.05 here in London. We'll be right back. You're tuned in to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are tuned in to Midori House. The time is 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now on there with their take on the news today is Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, and James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Welcome both to
Thank you. Programme.
And we're going to start off with two very different case studies in democracy for the Arab world today, Egypt and Tunisia. This week, both countries are expected to approve new constitutions. Egypt, at the moment, is poised with the third referendum in as many years since the ousting of President Mohamed Morsi in 2011. And Shashank, I'm going to come to you first on this. What's going on in Egypt? We keep going round and round in circles.
Yes, Groundhog Day. This is the third referendum like this in 3 years. And the answer, I think, Egypt's generals have decided is if you didn't like the first answer, keep asking them until they say yes. The signs all point to the fact that Egyptians will say yes, yes to the new constitution that's pretty much the same as the last one, the one that the Islamists had, with a few small differences, a few better protections for religious minorities, expanded powers for the army. But what this is really about is a referendum on whether the population supports the army kicking out the Muslim Brotherhood last year. They are treating it as, say, a referendum on their legitimacy, and the army chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is treating it as a referendum on his own mandate to run for president. So, in other words, Egypt is heading in the direction of many fantastic military-dominated regimes of the past that you know and love.
And how explicit is this new military leader's sort of grappling for power? I mean, do people...
Explicit and it's comical. He had a dream where he thinks the former president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, came to him and said, "You have to run for president." And he said, I know, I'm dreaming. I've been dreaming about this." So, you know, if you liked Egypt past military rulers, you'll love al-Sisi. But it's explicit. Everyone in Egypt thinks so. It's become more obvious as time has gone on. I put a decent wager on al-Sisi replacing his uniform or keeping it on, but adding on some extra presidential baubles by the end of the year.
And this is sort of sounding, There is a sort of an amusing sort of subtext to this stuff, but this is kind of dangerous stuff. You know, there were not only 2 years ago were sort of more famous leaders in North Africa and across the Middle East who obviously wore these sorts of uniforms, who maybe started in a similar vein. Is there anything like that that could happen in Egypt? I mean, does the constitution allow a get out clause for the population to rid themselves of a leader?
Well,
such as
the
this?
Get out clause is mass protest. And of course, the mass protests against President Mohamed Morsi last year were bigger than those, probably, we can't say for sure, bigger than those in Tahrir Square in 2011. So that is the valve. That's what the Arab Spring has done. It isn't everything gets better. It's that people power is evident. The problem, of course, is that that valve only really operates completely when someone actually conducts the coup in the final instance. Who can do that? It's the people with the guns. It's the army. Who checks the army? Who guards the guardians? In Egypt, unfortunately, no one does, which is why, despite their undeniable popularity, I think no one can really deny that, they've been able to machine gun thousands of Islamists, lock them up, ban the party that won a dominated parliament last year with impunity, and no one really cares all that much.
James, I'd like to bring you in at this point as we head across the border to Tunisia to look at their constitution, which we're holding up in this Top Gear edition of constitutions as being this is exactly how to do a constitution. Clearly far from perfect, but do the Egyptians have something to learn from the Tunisians in this regard, or is it just such a different country in the first place that maybe never the twain shall meet?
Well, it is a case of wow, what a difference! I mean, you couldn't get further from the further apart, and it really is exactly as Shashank was saying, that in Egypt there's the military, and there's very little that can be done to remove military power and sort of military negotiations in the kind of social settlement about what kind of country it's going to be. And in Tunisia, it's you just see it's very, very different. It's been difficult. It's been tense. Mm. There's been protests. It's not been easy.
There have been assassinations,
but it has been generally speaking mature. People have compromised, and the balance of social forces haven't really been on any one side. So, in both cases, there's this kind of rotating coalition between the different forces. And in the Egyptian case, some sides can get together and win, and in the Tunisian case, you can't. So in Tunisia, you've got...
So there's in the wording of the constitution itself, there is much more room, wiggle room for people, and much more democracy perhaps written into it.
Yeah, but I think it's important when we're talking about the constitutions, it's not necessarily what the documents are that are the most important. It's the way in which the society is formed out of those documents and what the passing of those documents means about the balance of forces within the society. So in Tunisia, balance of forces, you've got youth movements, street protest of various guises. You've got a kind of moderate establishment Islamists. You've got the opposition parties from before Ben Ali's regime. You've got the old regime and the kind of former elite who are still trying to keep in power. And then you've got the kind of hardline Salafists. And no alliance of those groups can win. So one group will protest, one group will do something else. And in the end, they're kind of just saying, right, we'll come to an agreement. In Egypt, you've just got three groups. They're each very strong, but two sides can beat the other one. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got the street, and you've got the military. And, sadly, that doesn't balance.
And the most important point I think you made was about compromise. Mm. Not just the army in Tunisia, smaller, more professional than Egypt, but it's luckier to have better Islamists. Mm. When Morsi governed, he governed to usurp power, to hoard power, and as an authoritarian style. Tunisia's Islamists have not been perfect, and there have been issues, but ultimately, when push comes to shove, they have been willing to go, and they've been willing to be much more flexible than Egypt's Islamists ever were.
I also think part of that is because Tunisia's Islamists didn't have a majority when there was an election. They got about 40%. So the government that they formed was always a coalition, and the two parties of coalition with are actually kind of centre-left secularist parties. So they were never really ever in a position to really kind of push a stronger agenda, which is very positive. The other thing in the way transition has been framed, Egypt, I think, made a big mistake by electing a president that had presidential powers, because it creates a figurehead and an idea that government is the government to stay. Tunisia elected a constitutional assembly. The assembly was only meant to last as long as it could form a constitution, and then you have new elections. So the government there was always basically a transitional government.
And presumably it teaches the populace and the electorate to believe in the constitution itself rather than a man at the top, right?
Especially in both societies where you've had, big personality cult figures, it is very important to see that actually, to affect change, it is different types of negotiations between different people, and no one is totally dominant.
Is there a case for an Egypt? It sounds like Tunisia's success, qualified as it is as a success, is because there are so many different parties, so many different voices that maybe peace will out, at least in terms of the constitution, because there needs to be so much fine tuning of it all the time. Discussion is rife. Would there ever be the opportunity to allow more voices into the debate in Egypt, or is it only in the interest of the military to quash
the discussion?
Well, if you look at their behaviour, they certainly don't seem as though they're interested in a meaningful debate. Let's look at this new constitution. Mm. The only really real answer you can give is yes. Those who have campaigned against the new constitution or the text have been silenced. They've been arrested. My favourite episode was one in which a group of people held up a sign saying no to thuggery from the Interior Ministry, which of course was despised under Mubarak, responsible for police abuses, in response to which policemen turned up and said, you know, do you think we're thuggish? Is this thuggish? And promptly beat them up, you know, proving exactly the point. You also have instances where anyone who's campaigned against the Constitution has been arrested, their post is torn down, and the state organs, the press, propaganda arms, have made huge efforts to show that this is a vote against terrorism, against the Brotherhood, in favour of democracy and in favour of stability. So really, those are no circumstances under which a serious national debate, let alone the fine-tuning to which you referred, can really take place. This is a constitution that is being rammed through and is not one that has really gone through a process of real baptism by public fire.
Maybe you can tell us some of the, maybe you can sort of illustrate some of the scenes at the polling stations, possibly. How's this constitution and the voting for it being administered? Are people being shoved into polling booths by the butt of a rifle? How did it work in Tunisia? How's it working out in Egypt, physically in the booth?
Perhaps? Well, in Tunisia, the population isn't voting because they're still, the Constitutional Assembly is still going through the draft constitution, article by article. But in the voting, in the polling today and yesterday in Egypt, it's less that people have been dragged out of houses by gunpoint saying you go and vote, but they've actually been rather clever with their propaganda. So rather than trying to force people to vote, they're worried about people saying it's low turnout.
Yeah.
So they've issued releases saying turnout is so high that we've had to bus in extra judges to oversee polling stations, or this polling station is unable to operate for the next 2 hours because there's so many people trying to come out and vote. So they've kind of, because they dominate the airwaves to such a degree, because so much of the Muslim Brotherhood or Islamist supporting media has been aggressively shut down, they're able to manipulate events in exactly the same way, really, that the Mubarak regime did.
I think the way to put it succinctly would be to say it's a free vote, it's just a grossly unfair vote.
I think that sounds like the bottom line on that. That was the voice of Shoshank Joshi from RUSI. We're also joined by James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. We're going to take a short break. You're tuned into Midori House at 18:17 here in London. We'll be having a little bit more of this with a difference. We'll be heading more into Africa on our return. We'll be back in a sec.
Contemporary Czech designers are embracing age-old bohemian glassmaking traditions and mixing in new techniques to create modern products with soul. Monocle Films pays a visit to some of the country's most clear-thinking glass alchemists.
Original decoration, this is very difficult, and it must be about emotions. And if I'm teaching students, I'm speaking about mentality of glassmakers, that it's not good to be proud only. Artists must be humble too.
Clear vision, check glass. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And And welcome back to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Shashank Joshi, research fellow at RUSI, and James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Let's turn now to a broad focus on extremism in both the Middle East and Africa, from Syria and Nigeria to Kenya and Libya, if we've got time. I mean, that sounds sounds like a game of Top Trumps. We're going to start in Syria, where it's been alleged that security officials from Western nations have been cooperating with the Syrian government in fear of the rise in influence of Islamist militants within the opposition rebel ranks. Shashank, this sort of muddies the waters a bit. I mean, was this to be expected, or is it just the fact that it's come out that makes
it? They were pretty muddy waters to begin with, I'd say. You know, you've got 1,200 European Muslims who've travelled to Syria since the beginning of the conflict. Now, as I've said, I think many times here before, that's the biggest contingent of European Muslim fighters to any conflict in the history of this planet anywhere. That's huge. For some countries, you're just about population, like Denmark or Belgium, relative to their Muslim population, relative to their police numbers. This is a huge risk. They've seen what happened in Afghanistan in the 80s, Bosnia after that, Iraq after that. These people are going to come back and they're going to cause potentially trouble even to the point of terrorism plots. That's why they want to talk to the Assad regime. They want to know where these guys are. They want to know what they're doing, what they're up to, which groups they're fighting with. This is driven by pure necessity, I think. And it's domestic intelligence agencies, more than foreign ones, in other words, MI5 rather than MI6, who are the ones who are really interested in this stuff. So no surprise. Does it mean Assad is staying? Does it mean they think Assad is going to survive? I'm not sure it necessarily means that, although his assessed lifespan has gone up, of course. Mm-hmm. What it really means is they are petrified of the rise of jihadis within the rebel ranks, not just ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq in al-Sham, which has, of course, flourished now in northern Syria and, of course, in Anbar province, but also Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Nusra Front. These groups are muscling out the more moderate rebels who are sandwiched between the jihadis and the Salafis. And Western intelligence agencies would be remiss, I think, if they didn't try and understand all that they could about this threat. That it's leaked out, of course, will be absolutely a source of dismay for them, because it undoubtedly is a propaganda coup for the Assad regime.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, it comes down, you're saying, almost more of a police-to-police. Scotland Yard talking to the Syrian police almost, rather than a swooping international intelligence mission.
I won't pretend it's just that, because MI6 did send a retired official, but the fact he was retired shows you how sensitive these issues still are. But go back 10 years, the Assad regime, Iraq war, Assad regime in the axis of evil, sending fighters into Iraq. Damascus is a conduit for sending fighters in. This secular regime is sending jihadis into Iraq next door. Yet the Bush administration at the time still spoke to Syria. We had a police liaison with Syria. So we cooperated with this adversarial regime even in those worst moments. So of course we'll still think about doing it now. It causes a political headache because we said Assad must go, but countries talk to each other even when they're in these kind of relationships in a lot of circumstances. In other words, that's what, you know, some people would say that's what intelligence agencies are for.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? I wondered if I could speak to you, James, about the leaking of it, about what that does, about whether there's a precedent for that, whether there's been a precedent for that with other regimes, where you fly the flag for freedom so much, and then when necessity bites, you have to basically do business with the hated dictator that's there at the time.
Yeah, I mean exactly as Shashank was saying, it doesn't look particularly good, and it doesn't help the kind of official narrative that Western states are putting forward. But in the kind of real world of counterterrorism and crime prevention, you can see exactly how this comes about. And you see actually with all sorts of regimes. I mean, in the African continent, let's take Robert Mugabe, who officially is anathema in the West, who actually now they're quite a lot of signs they're trying to basically smooth relations, because they realize that whilst they loathe him, it would be easier to operate alongside him, or he's not going away, so you have to deal with him. And I think that's really Assad's success here, and it's why it's such a big PR coup for him, because his narrative from the beginning of the uprising, which frankly sounded deranged to most people then, was these people are all terrorists, this is all Al-Qaeda, which wasn't the case then, but it sort of became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it it really has been a failure of at least in on the kind of discoursal level of Western foreign policy in how quickly the Syrian opposition was reached out to, at least in speeches, and how we, you know, the Western countries didn't really have as well as say Russia did analysis of how the military fight would go. So we've basically taken a big step forward, put ourselves out there, and now it's looking a bit difficult.
Clearly, neither of you two are surprised that this has come out, that this stuff happens all the time. Do you think it's surprising for your general newspaper reader, radio listener, that this sort of emollient, smooth action is always happening under the surface? Do you think other people might be surprised?
Zoom out, and let me give you another example of this, zooming outside to the broader Middle East. 10 years ago, the UK was giving Iran, this is Iran, included again in the axis of evil, the country which we were ostensibly consider a dictatorship, £1 million a year for counter-narcotics cooperation. We were giving them rifles, jeeps, you know, night vision goggles to cooperate against heroin smuggling in Afghanistan. We were, in 2001, we worked with the Iranian Special Forces to fight the Taliban, and they cooperated with us to give us the addresses and details on Al-Qaeda suspects in Afghanistan. For a lot of these regimes, Al-Qaeda and other Sunni extremist organizations are a common adversary. Counterterrorism cooperation, of course, even exists between the US and Russia, two nations that again have a whole host of issues separating them. I think what you have to remember here is intelligence agencies like to operate in the shadows. They like to have these deniable back channel talks as much as they can. Again, the UK and Libya would be another example, hence all the fuss over potentially illegal extradition and the UK's role in extraditing people to the Libyan authorities against our own laws. You know, so the intelligence agencies would say, we can operate in the shadows and we should do this because no one else can. It can't be done publicly. The problem is, I think, when it comes out into the open.
James, you wanted to...
I think that's precisely the point. When we're talking about Western intelligence agencies, we're not talking about the governments. They're not part of the governments. They're part of the state. Mm-hmm. And so they are in some ways insulated, and it's designed for them to be in some senses insulated from whatever, you know, political actions are taking place. And so it shouldn't seem, it, you know, it might surprise some listeners and some viewers and some readers, but I don't think it really should.
And there's presumably some sort of slightly bald PR effort to be made in saying, well, of course we're speaking to both sides. We're your government. We should be doing this. Or at least we are the state and we should be doing
this. Well, that's how it could be spun. I think, though, at this point...
I'm not going to get a job in the behind number 10.
Assad right. must go has become such a mantra, I think, that anything that clashes with that is very, very difficult.
We named some other nations in the top in our menu. We're going to go to Nigeria very quickly. There's been a Boko Haram attack. James, maybe you could fill our listeners in on what it is. And amongst all these names that we've spun for the last half hour on this show, where did Boko Haram fit into this narrative?
So Boko Haram is a kind of militant Islamist group in the northeast of Nigeria. And there's an attempt at the moment to try to slot them into the kind of Al-Qaeda model, as people are discussing. But that's not really what they are. They are extremely violent. They've killed several thousand people in now hundreds of attacks. But their kind of operations are, you know, rather different when we're talking about Al Qaeda in Syria and Iraq. It's a very different beast, and the way in which they're being dealt with, the Nigerian government has got a very aggressive military strategy against them, which has its own human rights abuses, and there was a report that something like 1,000 people have died in detention, have been arrested for being Boko Haram. And, you know, again, the Nigerian government is being supported, and they're trying to in some ways play up the international dimension of Boko Haram, because they receive especially UK and US support in their kind of counter-terrorism.
I was going to ask, to follow on from that last subject, what we might be doing.
Yeah, so the US and the UK are providing technical support and some other intelligence support for dealing with Boko Haram. But the problem with anybody dealing with Boko Haram is there's a very fluid identity for what Boko Haram is. So all sorts of attacks will be claimed as Boko Haram. All sorts of people kind of pop up and say, I am Boko Haram, come and negotiate with me. And then someone else from Boko Haram says, no, I mean, you've got nothing to do with us. You're just some random person trying to get a bit of money saying I can negotiate with them for a couple of million dollars. So you're operating in a real kind of information, not vacuum, but close to that, relative to the kind of more known about Islamist insurgencies or Islamist militant groups that exist elsewhere in the world.
The plot thickens. We've got some other places. We're not going to have time to get to those. We got down as far as Nigeria, but not up back again.
Pretty good span.
Libya, or down across to Kenya. There's a lot of trouble to cover. Thank you, gentlemen, both Choshank Joshi from RUSI and James Schneider from Think Africa Press. Thank you very much for joining us. Come back in a second, because it'll be at the bottom of the hour. It'll be news time again with David Spencer.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyo. Se om Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with Aman in Budapest, discover new brands at Bread and Butter in Berlin, and talk TV with The Telegraph's Alice Vincent here in the studio. But before we get started, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says donors have promised more than $2.4 billion in humanitarian aid for Syria. He was speaking at a conference in Kuwait to discuss the crisis-hit country, where the civil war has now lasted almost 3 years. The pledges come after an appeal for $6.5 billion that was launched last month by the UN. Bomb attacks and shootings across Iraq have killed at least 75 people. In one of the bloodiest days in months, there were separate attacks in Baghdad and a village north of the capital, as well as in Mosul. A unilateral ceasefire declared by Colombia's FARC rebels over the holidays has ended. The organisations accuse the Colombian government of continuing military action during the month-long truce. Britain has told its European Union partners that the EU's treaties are not fit for purpose and there must be reform or it would quit the bloc. Finance Minister George Osborne said EU treaties had to be changed to protect member states like his own that don't use the euro. Apple is to refund at least $32.5 million to customers to settle a long-standing complaint over charges that people incurred after children bought mobile apps without their parents' consent. A Japan Airlines Dreamliner remains grounded at Tokyo's international airport as regulators demand checks to see if the aircraft is fit to fly. On Tuesday, smoke came from a part of the plane and a battery cell showed signs of melting. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24, where it's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, but not from one of the places we listed. We're going over to our man in Budapest, Adam Labor. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Good evening.
I think you should give us a time update from Budapest. Are you 2 hours ahead?
We're 1 hour ahead of GMT, so it's 7:33 here in the evening.
I think you've squared the circle nicely there with our time announcements. First on the menu to talk about is the list for the general election has finally been announced. Those on the left of Hungarian politics have been tarrying on this, right?
Yes, after basically 3 years of squabbling and arguing over who's going to head the list, which parties are going to be on the list, they finally agreed to put the list together. And at the top of it, we see Attila Mesterházy, who's the leader of the Socialist Party. And behind him, coming in at number two, is a man called Gordon Bainai, who is a former prime minister, a kind of non-ideological centrist technocrat type. Who was prime minister for a year, an interesting guy because he took a salary of precisely one forint, less than a cent, during that time. And then he's followed by another former prime minister called Ferenc Gyurcsány, a very controversial former socialist prime minister. And then we have assorted liberals and center leftists. But the main question is, why has it taken so long?
Because
it's just like 3 or 4 months away from the election, probably going to be in April or May. And now it's only in January that they can start campaigning properly and people actually know who the prime minister or the candidate for the left is.
There's not a lot of time to put the posters up and get those TV spots organised, Adam. What has been, is it infighting within the parties themselves, the election processes within the parties?
Well, a lot of it is basically infighting between the different parties because, as you can imagine, there was a lot of disputes and squabbling over who gets the top spot, the number one spot on the list, which to be the prime minister if the United List wins. And in the end, the socialists won, which makes more sense because they're, you know, they are the descendants of the Communist Party and they have the most organization, you know, love or hate their politics. They're certainly still a force to be reckoned with, whereas the other parties are all much newer groupings that have kind of split off from the socialists or reforms like, you know, amoebas splitting and regrouping. So, I mean, politics here is in a state of flux, and what you see in Hungary is what you see in the left, on the left in lots of countries, including Britain, is a, you know, this kind of question of what does it actually stand for? Because everyone now just wants to manage and make a more effective capitalism. I suppose they hear their argument is that we need to look after the poor people and do more against poverty because there is a lot of poverty in Hungary.
And presumably,
like Budapest.
And just finally on this election story, presumably there are a lot of social issues, as we said, that can only be, or that perhaps are only being talked about by the left-wing parties.
Yeah, so left-wing is making quite a lot of noise and starting to about poverty. And I think that could be something that gets some support because different statistics say between 30 and 40% of the population here live on or below the poverty line. Now, the average wage a month is less than $1,000 a month, of which one third is usually taken away in taxes and social security. And if you go shopping here for a basket of food, it's not much cheaper than it is in London. In fact, when I'm in London, some things in Tesco in London are actually cheaper than in Budapest. So there's widespread poverty here.
We're going next to, well, there's a bomb blast in Budapest on Monday. The police have had a dust around. What's the news on that? What's the police verdict on how this was brought about?
Well, this is a very unusual and very almost bizarre story. There was a bank in a part of northern Budapest, in a sort of suburban area near a metro station, had a wall blown out at about 4 o'clock in the morning. There doesn't seem to have been any attempt at robbery. No one's really claimed responsibility for it. And all we've heard is that there was a motorcyclist, may or may not have been involved, who apparently told the homeless people sleeping in their metro station to kind of clear off, which they did. I mean, nobody was hurt, but you know, it is a serious thing. It was a real bomb, and it really blew up the bank, at least blew out a big wall of it. And people are kind of wondering, I mean, banks here are extremely unpopular at the moment because so many people here have taken out foreign currency loans. They took them out a few years ago, even though they're paid in forints. Their loans are denominated in Swiss francs when it was like 170 forints to Swiss francs. And now you're looking at more than 230, 235, something like that. So, you know, the value of the cost of these loans has soared. The value of the properties is pretty static, and there's a lot of bad feeling against the banks. But really, it's a very odd event because no one's taken responsibility for it. And thankfully, it's not a city where things are normally getting blown up.
No, indeed. Just possibly a potential, aberration, a protest, possibly. Strange to do it at 4 a.m, although I suppose perhaps no one wanted to hurt anyone else, just make a point.
Intent to get... you know, it doesn't seem like there's an intent to hurt people, but it's pretty risky business when you start setting bombs off.
We do have a good news item to end on, Adam. Cycling's taking off. Is this a sort of urbanism scheme, or is this just because gas is too pricey, even in the winter?
It's a bit of both. I mean, what you're seeing here is there's a lot more cycle lanes than there used to be. I mean, when I've lived here for a long time, and it used to be you'd have to be a real brave person to cycle out in the Hungarian traffic. I mean, Hungarian drivers simply weren't used to cyclists. They didn't have any kind of spatial sense that there might be a bike coming up. And also, I've got to say, a lot of cyclists are quite dangerous here. I mean, they don't, you know, you see them at night with no lamps, wearing dark clothes, and they can be quite invisible. But that seems to be changing now. There's more of a cycling culture, as I say, more cycling lanes. You see many more cyclists on the road. And also there's a generation coming up in their 20s and 30s who are traveling and going abroad, and they see that other cities, people are cycling around. And Budapest is very manageable. I mean, if you're downtown, the kind of the essential core of the city, you can cycle to, across it in 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, or you can cycle, between a good three or four bridges along the riverside in about 20 minutes. So it's a good city for cycling in terms of size. It's not like London, where you've got to sit on your bike for 45 minutes to get in from the suburb downtown.
And how
to be welcomed.
And have these cycle lanes been sort of popular? How have the sort of campaigns gone down to lay out these extra bits of tarmac on the side of the roads?
Well, I think the city gets a lot of money from the European Union, and there's just a sense that, a modern city has cycle lanes. And, for many years there was critical mass, where people kind of took over the city and cyclists were, taking over the roads. And there's just a kind of growing sense of it. And plus, of course, it's cheap. It's free to cycle somewhere once you pay for the bike. So it's definitely getting more popular.
Adam Blabor, thank you very much. Our man in Lycra, possibly our man in Budapest, certainly. Thank you very much for that. Stay tuned. We're going to be in Berlin for Bread and Butter. That's Togs, not Toast. Stay tuned.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Brown.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Robert Bound, 1841. We're going to Berlin with Europe's fashion weeks and trade shows in full swing in January. Berlin's Bread and Butter kicked off yesterday, showcasing casual wear by about 600 international brands. Launched in 2001, it complements Berlin Fashion Week, and it's run by managing director Karl-Heinz Müller, who's also the man behind Berlin's renowned multi-brand store, 14 Ounce. Our Toronto bureau chief, Nelly Gotcheva, is currently at Bread and Butter, checking out the latest offerings by established names such as Canada Goose, Barber, Filson, Penfield, Museum and Carhartt, but also catching up with newer brands like Detroit-based Schinella. Earlier today, Nelly spoke to Tom Edwards about her first impressions of this edition of Bread and Butter.
Bread and Butter just launched yesterday, and for those that are not aware of the fair, it's a three-day independent fashion fair or gathering of brands from around the world. It is mostly focusing more casual wear, and it's targeting the mid-range market.
And tell me, how long has Bread and... Because it's a bit of a fixture now, isn't it, Bread and Butter? How long has it been around, and what does this kind of big fashion market... What does everyone make of Bread and Butter? Is it a popular thing? Are people still a bit wary about this relative newcomer?
It's well established, especially in the country, and it's really well known in Berlin and I think in Europe as well. It's been around since 2001, so it's just over a decade old. And as I just said, it's known as Berlin, probably kind of edgier and hip fashion gathering. It's currently the brands that are on show right now, because it happens twice a year. So the brands that are currently on show, they're showing their autumn winter 2014-2015 collections. So basically, if you want to know what will be trendy on the streets of Europe, especially next winter, this is the place to be right now.
Well, normally I would always just ask you, Nelly, of course. You always seem to know what's going to be trendy. You're always a year ahead. And who have you been speaking to, Nelly? Any sort of these established brands or some of the newer players? Did you manage to catch up with everyone while you were hot-footing it around bread and butter?
I just got here, so I've only spent this afternoon at the fair, but I've been pretty lucky because I managed to caught up with Shinola and the CEO, Steve Bock. So they are one of the newcomers to Bread and Butter. It's a Detroit-based brand, and they only launched less than 1 year ago, so this is their first time at Bread and Butter. Our readers maybe know that Shinola offers watches, bicycles, leather diaries, shoe polish, and their own Shinola cola. But what's really interesting about them is that they're, as I said, they're based in Detroit and everything is made in the U.S. So we managed to have a quick chat with Mr. Bock about, I was really curious to find out how Berlin's been treating them so far and how popular they're getting in Europe, but also what's going on in Detroit and, of course, what future holds for Shinola.
Two locations are on our target. One is Berlin, one is London. Hopefully both of them, once we find the right locations, let's say within the next 9 to 12 months.
And as far as Europe is concerned, you're also presently available at Colette in Paris. Where else in Europe?
So at the moment, it's very narrowly distributed. We have 3 locations. The brand, as you know, has only been on the market for the last 6 months in the United States. So today we are, to your point, in Colette, both 14-ounce stores here in Berlin. And what we're doing now is we will slowly open a very narrow level of distribution throughout Europe, looking for very fine, very specific retailers in various cities, perhaps 8 or 10 retailers throughout Europe, and take distribution and the business up in a very, very slow way.
So do you find Europe different or challenging compared to the States in terms of distributing and kind of making a new brand popular?
Well, I think it's clearly different. The market here is a very sophisticated market. We've spent a lot of time on quality of product. As you know, our watches are assembled in Detroit, and we assemble them by bringing the component parts of a movement from Switzerland. Equipment comes from Switzerland. The trainers come from Switzerland. All of that is moved into Detroit, and so we assemble both the movements and the watches in Detroit. So what we have today is a watch that is of the finest Swiss quality, given the movements, made, of course, in the United States in Detroit. And that, to us, is a very critical part of what is going to be appealing to a European customer.
And speaking of Detroit, and given the challenges the city had last year, so how is it doing now, and how are smaller businesses and manufacturing coping in the city at the moment?
Yeah, Detroit is an iconic city. It's a brand unto itself. If you ask anybody here in Europe, if you ask anybody at this fair, at Bread and Butter today, do they know about Detroit? Everybody will have an opinion about Detroit. There are two parts, like every city, there are 2, 3, 5 parts to it. Detroit clearly has a part to it that has struggled for many decades, financial difficulties, really very, very difficult challenges. And they are slowly in the process of working those out. Our focus, however, is on the future of Detroit. And we believe, based on the heritage of that city, the fact that the automobile industry comes from there in the United States, the music industry on a global basis, craftsmanship, you know, the beauty of craftsmanship, of workmanship. People are eager to work and really build and create wonderfully creative and a product of great quality. That's the key part to it. So on that basis, we see a very exciting future for Detroit. So when we combine our design, the quality of our product, the value that we put into it, and the city of Detroit, we think we've got a watch, a bike, a journal, leather products, Shinola cola, and shoe polish that will be very appealing to a European customer.
And speaking of your line of products, are you planning to add more in your future?
Just the beginning. There's much more coming. So I'm not going to be able to share with you what that is today because it's not finalized. But these six category lines that we have today are just the basis of where we're going to go. And they all tie together. I think it's very important to talk about the fact that most people, when they hear that we manufacture shoe polish and bikes and journals and watches, say, how does it all tie together? It doesn't tie together from a product standpoint, but when you look at it from a design, quality, and value standpoint, then it clearly ties together in a very succinct way.
So that, Nelly, was Steve Bock talking to you at Bread and Butter. Just tell me, what will be the sort of lasting impressions that you take away from the event, do you think, this year? Will it be of a sector in very rude health? Will it be how many new and diverse names were there? Basically, will you already be booking your ticket for next year's event?
I hope so, because the next one is the summer, so I'm really looking forward to it, to see what I'm really curious when I go to those events. It's catching up with established brands that we know, but also it's very, very interesting to find new brands. And I think that Berlin specifically is very good at launching and kind of promoting new and independent brands. So yes, I am booking up my tickets.
That was Nelly Gotcheva in Berlin at Bread and Butter, speaking with our Tom Edwards a little earlier on. Tune into Section D next week for more on Bread and Butter. Up next, TV with Alice Vincent. ...1850 here in London. You're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the show, but as promised, just before that track... Except I didn't play the track, I just read out the thing as if it was actually there. That's what happened, because Alice Vincent's here, and she's so good on TV, we thought we'd scrap the track. But I thought I'd read it out anyway.
It's very kind.
It's time for us to catch up on the world of TV. Alice, welcome
Hello.
To the show. Alice Vincent from The Telegraph, we should point out. By the way, what's been floating your boat? We wanted to first talk about the Golden Globes.
Sure, yeah. It's been a big week for Golden Globes. The awards season is really kicking off. Oscars nominations tomorrow. So
yeah.
the biggest thing with Golden Globes, please, for Breaking Bad fans, they finally won one.
And we've got a clip. In fact, we should sort of start as we mean to go on. Aaron Paul. This is Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. This is how he reacted to winning.
Actually, the best person to say it, I think, would be Aaron Paul. Aaron, you wanna? Yeah, bitch. Thank you.
And of course, they didn't know he was going to say that. It's very unscripted. There was a drum roll to meet that. So has Breaking Bad been kind of overlooked then in the awards season, the nominations?
It's been weird. It's done very well Emmys-wise, but it's really not racked up that many Golden Globes. And I think this year was a really big win for Bryan Cranston, who plays Walter White, because he's been nominated in the Golden Globes consecutively for 3 years. And finally, he's got the gong. So... there's a lot of fans pleased for him.
He's got the gong. The Golden Globes, I always like the Golden Globes as well, because it sort of has less pressure than the Oscars. Also, it does that thing which we should really... it kind of recalibrates how people actually enjoy their TV or their film entertainment. It mixes it together. You know, it's a nice mix of seeing TV stars and film stars on the red carpet and mixing it all up, as obviously people kind of tend to enjoy it at home, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And can we sort of look into a crystal ball at all and see what this might augur for the Oscars? As you say, nominations are for tomorrow.
Yeah, they are. So obviously Oscars doesn't dwell as much on TV, but it's interesting at the moment. American Hustle film-wise is looking more likely than it was before the Golden Globes, because it went in as a bit of an outsider and managed to pick up three. So seeing if they get nominated.
There's stronger categories. You know, there's obviously those years when there's sort of four great people or four great films in one category of five. There's always one that you kind of can't believe that's slightly there. What are the sort of hot categories for you? What were maybe the most hotly contested ones? There were a lot of kind of good, great female performances, I thought, this year.
Amazing.
For example.
And it was great to see such diversity in the age range as well.
Yeah.
Everyone from Jennifer Lawrence all the way up to Judi Dench. It was a really great year for older women actresses, Cate Blanchett, Helen Mirren. So that was good. And also actors as well. Interesting between whether Chiwetel's going to get it or Idris. Yeah. Strong for British actors.
Yeah. We're going to go to girls next.
Great.
It's season three.
It is
kicking off. Mm-hmm. We're going to whet our listeners' appetite, get them back into the girls' fold. We've got a little clip to play first.
I'm really, really not hungry, so maybe you can just order me pancakes and turkey bacon. And then I guess if they don't have turkey bacon, I'll have regular bacon and a milkshake, thank you.
It's really amazing that all three of you have accomplished so little in the 4 years since college. I mean, like, think about it, 4 years.
4 years is like nothing.
You can't break up with me. I wouldn't be eating pizza in front of you if I actually liked you.
You know, if you wrote down all these business lessons, then you wouldn't have to spout embarrassing platitudes in public.
Do you think that I think this is the best use of my myriad talents?
You know, happiness is about appreciating what you have.
Hey, hey, Deepak Chopra, I'm sick of your shit.
Sounds like a Monocle editorial meeting, but it wasn't. It was Girls Season 3 trailer. Sure. What can we look forward to? How do you feel? How do you feel it might be moving on?
Well, we were left in a really interesting place at the end of Season 2. Season 1 was very lighthearted, very funny, and Season 2, suddenly it was like, is this still a comedy? I've got to admit, I've seen a tiny bit of Season 3 already, and it's somewhere in the middle. And I think that basically the episodes are still not long enough for the amount that Lena Dunham has enough talent to pour into. It's going to be good.
Is it one of those shows you think by this point that it becomes, it sort of broadens itself out? It's the point in a show's kind of lifespan when it can grab more viewers. Do you see the writing changing maybe to make it less of a fan show, and I guess three series down the line, it obviously is paying its way, but do you see self-conscious writing to try and broaden its base maybe?
Well, the interesting thing is that it's never been a big show for ratings. So it was its peak premiere in the US on Sunday and it had 1.3 million viewers. It's not a big show. But I think Lena, her viewers and the people who want to watch it, they want to watch it because of the fact she writes so differently. There's no chance of her selling out. So.
Right. Now, that's an interesting thing. I also wondered about this because I was invited to some quite big sort of junket, red carpet junket for Girls. And I kind of want, that's not normally the way for TV shows. And I wonder whether it was kind of trying to do a real push. I mean, this is obviously a UK event.
Sure.
I was invited to. But yeah. I just wondered that, you know what I mean, about the sort of bit of a push for it.
It's interesting. I gather there's 450 people going to that tonight. So, yeah,
okay.
It's a big deal. And you're right. You know, Lane is on the cover of Girls of Vogue next month, and it is a global thing. It seems like the media are more interested in it than the viewers, perhaps. It's weird.
I don't want to use high functioning sociopath in the same sentence as Lena Dunham, but we are going to go and talk about Sherlock.
Right.
Now, we can't really, we are based in London. We have to kind of tick this one off the list. We're literally spitting distance from 221B Baker Street. This was a short and sweet series, three kind of feature length episodes. Do you think people kind of got what they wanted? It seemed to be very self-referential this time around.
Yeah. I think if you're a hardcore fan, then you loved it. But if you were a normal TV viewer, then you were angry because it was riddled with plot holes. Some people felt like the writers had promised more than they gave. But I think it was still entertaining. It's very entertaining.
It is sort of like one of those things where you're watching it and it's absolutely, sort of, it is wonderful entertainment, and it's done all those things that we always wondered how to do, like to involve sort of modern communication techniques in drama and all those sort of things. And the two actors are fantastic in it. Obviously two big film stars we forget nowadays as well in our little sort of BBC TV series. But I guess it was. It did have that sort of slight whiff of self-congratulation about it.
Very much. And it was sort of a smug patting themselves on the back. But at the same time, if you watched it and you watch it on Twitter, then you love the fact that they referenced all of the Twitter stuff. So it just depends on who you are when you're watching it.
We've now got 20 seconds, unfortunately, to do Netflix.
Okay.
So we're going to do it short and sweet. This is sort of announcement time for Netflix,
sure,
isn't it?
Yes. They are bringing out Marco Polo. That is the, as yet untitled,
epic
big
Marco.
Yeah, they're going into historical drama. It sounds bloodthirsty and a bit sexy and very exciting.
It's nice. And met Netflix, of course, bestriding the entertainment world like a colossus itself.
Every single genre they seem to be dominating at the moment.
We're going to get Alice to come back in and just talk about Netflix, I think. We've run out of time, unfortunately. Alice Vincent from The Telegraph with new haircut.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. That's all we've got time for on this edition of Midori House. My thanks to Shoshank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and James Schneider, Editor of Think Africa, Africa Press. Today's show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luis Mendoza, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Next up, it's The Entrepreneurs, where we meet the man behind luxury clothing rental service Girl Meets Dress.
Everyone's bartered with their sisters, with their siblings, with their friends, right? Give me this, I'll swap you that. The only difference is that now we've got an infrastructure globally, a network of tech that makes that possible between complete strangers.
But for the time being, at the top of the hour, for me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.